Secretary of the Board, and I welcome you and thank you so much for coming out tonight. This is our last lecture of the season, and we'll be starting up again in September. But usually we hold, for 9 months of the year, we hold lectures here on the first Friday of the month. And whether you are new or a regular attendee, it doesn't matter. All are welcome, and we welcome you wholeheartedly here. We ask that you make a donation of $10 to cover our expenses. And we're not a membership organization, so anyone who comes, you are part of our community and part of the Western Mass, the Young Association of Western Mass. We do have a board, and our board consists of Carol, there she is, Carol Beauvais, treasurer, Dan Cronwald, webmaster, Erica Lorenz, who's not here tonight, she's our president, Christine Olson, Penelope Jurassic, there she is, Peter, who's our historian, and our advisor, Thayer Green. I also have a special announcement for a guest we have tonight, Barbara Bronson, who 20 years ago with Peter and Thayer started this organization. So we're 20 years old. We've completed our 20th year. Glad you're here.
For 10 people.
10 people.
Yeah, for 10 people.
Wow.
The club.
The club. We're definitely growing. So, let's see. There's a book basket over there that books were donated to us, and they're usually some way related to the theme of the evening. Tonight's book basket has women authors, and there's a suggested donation list there on the table. And the bathrooms, there's one right here. We won't take a break. Sarah will go for about an hour, and so take a break as you need to. And there's one bathroom here, and then there's another bathroom just catty corner across the way. It says men's, but everybody uses it.
It's a Smith.
Right. After tonight's lecture, which will definitely end by 9, we have an informal salon, we call it, at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. I want to be sure to tell you about our website, westmassyoung.org. It's on our brochure. Yes, it's on our brochure. And there you can find out about lectures, upcoming lectures, and also you can, many of our lectures have been recorded, so you can listen to past lectures. You can also sign up to be on our email list on the website. So, speaking of starting up again in September, that will be actually the second Friday of the month because of Labor Day weekend. But we, our first offering of the year, we traditionally have a film and a panel, and it's usually more of an introductory nature to the ideas of life and work and ideas of Carl Jung or Jung-related theme. So sort of like a Jung 101. This year, we're planning to have a selection of a video called The Way of the Dream. And that's Fraser Boa collected first-person accounts, I'll read you the description, of dreams in street interviews with ordinary men and women, and then asked the eminent psychoanalyst Marie-Louise von Franz to interpret them. just as she would in a private analytical session. The resulting test is a primer explaining and demonstrating the art and science of dream analysis for the general public. The material covered includes dreams of men, women, what dreams tell us about ourselves, about death and dying. And so, as a, if you have friends or you know someone who's curious but might feel, you know, that like they're at sea about what Jungian work is, or that this might be a good time to come. So, and just a quick note about our community as. Our community is growing, so 10 at the first lecture. We have sometimes up to 70 in this room in a full house, and the community itself is beginning to have its own identity. People come back, and that has been noted by the board, and so we're thinking of having a way to include or to be a connecting point for community events that are Jung-related, Jungian-related. And so we'll just stay tuned. We'll have more of an announcement about that, but it'll be things that people hear about around town or that they want to offer themselves, and we'll publicize that on the website, so that'll go beyond our offerings of lectures and workshops, but it really could be all kinds of things, going to a movie and having a discussion afterwards. So that's probably in the fall, I think, we'll get more formal about doing that. Okay, that's it for announcements, unless you think I missed something. So actually, it is my pleasure tonight to introduce to you Sarah Jackson. I was here for her lecture last year, which was on what visual art can teach us. And I just sunk in and was really, really enjoyed it. So I've been especially, I enjoy all the lectures and I look forward to them, but this one I've been especially excited about. In addition to being a Jungian analyst, Sarah is a visual artist and a writer. She's had a private practice in Western Mass since 1990. And for the past 3 years, she's led a small weekly dream group, which Sarah told me is now organically mostly leading itself, which in the Jungian world makes sense. In 2013, Sarah completed her analytic training at the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. Her graduate thesis was on the female hero and the animus, but her thesis is an outgrowth of an interest in female heroes that goes back much further, and she'll be telling us about that tonight. In both 2014 and 2015, Sarah presented papers at the Dallas Institute of, it's a long title, Humanities and Cultures Annual James Hillman Symposium, and has lectured on the female hero in contemporary cinema for several colleges and city libraries, for the New York City Film Series, and the first Tuesday lunch lecture at the Jung Society of New York. So this is clearly a passion of hers and an interest. To round out this introduction, I'll tell you that these days, Sarah is happily trying to learn dressage and tango. Not together, but at the same time. And has spending as much time outdoors with her new labradoodle named Bella. So, Sarah Jackson, thank you.
So, if you want to have a question during, press, there's a question that you have, want to call out to me, like, can you hear me?
That's better.
Starters, better, yeah. During, as we go along, that's fine. Otherwise, we'll have some time at the end. I didn't give the credits for each image on the screen. I think it's a little distracting, but any image that you want to, you're curious about, just call out to me and I'll tell you what it is if I don't already explain it. Because putting the images together is that's the thing I love about doing these talks, really. And I like this juxtaposition. The Greek vase painting is of Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons, and she's juxtaposed with the younger of the two heroes of Crouching Tiger, a film which I will talk about at some length, and one woman who really was, as we know now from Jill Lepore's book about her, was inspired partly by Hippolyta and partly by Margaret Sanger, the pioneer of women's birth control. And I don't really talk about Wonder Woman other than having her here. So what first caught my interest about women, female heroes in cinema was the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon back in the year 2000. And that's when I felt like I was seeing something new, something different for the first time. And how many people have seen it? Almost everybody. That's great. It's an amazing film. And what really startled me was fairly well into the film, very demure young lady is traveling with her mother. Remember this scene? I'm going to play a clip from it in a moment. They're traveling across a desert and in carriages, pulled by horses, and the carriage is ambushed by bandits. And the young leader of the bandit sticks his head in the carriage and winks at the young lady and grabs her jade hair comb. Remember this scene? Mm-hmm. And then something very unexpected happens. The mother tries to pull her back and tells her to duck down. There isn't a light for this right here, is there?
I think it's hard to see. Yeah, it's fine. You can see fine.
Well, there isn't light up there. It's a little bit hard to see.
Yeah. You can bring up the light.
Just a touch. Or maybe just the ones in the front, if it doesn't affect the screen too much.
Would you like a flashlight?
Oh, we're fine.
No, that's not
fine.
Great.
No, that's fine. We can see all right.
It's for her.
Yes, she does.
And even with the light.
That's what I mean.
Would you like a flashlight?
No, I could do a flashlight.
No, I thought it was.
I don't think you need all the lights off. We can see the screen.
No. Well,
I just wondered about those right there. Those are not lights.
No, it is not.
We can see.
Thank you. That's great. Perfect.
We can see the screen just fine. So.
Yeah. Okay. So, what really caught my interest in the films, though, in the group of films that I'm going to talk about, this is the first of those, is that there are women characters in them who are fully occupying their physicality, pushing themselves to their physical and emotional limits, and beautiful young women who are not being seen primarily as sex objects, whose primary concern is not love and romance. However, almost all of these characters are tragic, even though each one of them prevails in her own way. And which I think reflects the position of women in society, both contemporary and historical, our travails and suffering, and the ways in which we have been and are still being exploited. However, these women are heroes, not victims, and so they're accomplishing, discovering, and deepening despite and through their suffering. So, let me play you this scene. This is going to take a minute to cue this up. I'm on a flash drive instead of my own computer. Okay. I don't know about volume walk to see.
Okay.
How that goes. It's a touch screen, right?
Yeah.
Wow, this is a long way. This is worse than home. I wonder if it's because of the ring. She grabbed a horse from another bandit and set out after him. Surprised me about that. I thought maybe that was just particular to martial arts movies, which I wasn't a genre I'm not so familiar with. But the way that she just launched into him and really occupied her physicality completely and relentlessly is a great chase scene. I'm sorry, the very beginning of it was a little bit interrupted. And indeed, there wasn't another movie like that, or there isn't any movie like that, but there wasn't another movie that seemed to be part of what I now think of as a group of films for some years. So I just kind of forgot about it. And in any case, however, the Amazon is, of course, a mythic figure that goes back to Artemis and before. And there are, however, many divine and semi-divine women who are much more objectified, as that's Europa on the left in a painting by Titian. As Simone de Beauvoir pointed out, women's objectification has to do with their bodies, and the body can also be a source of strength, mastery, and autonomy, as the great goddesses have always shown us. So there's really nothing new in these films in a way. And this is particularly true of the Hindu goddesses, here is Durga slaying an army of demons. The chief demon also being feminine, female, it seems. So here were the group of films that began to catch my interest. Initially it was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But then these other films came along. There was Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Swedish trilogy. The remake of True Grit, that's lower right-hand corner, by the Coen brothers. On the upper middle left is a still from the film, French-Canadian Quebecois film called Incendie, that's about a woman caught in the Lebanese Civil War. Above her is the youngest hero, Hush Puppy, from Beasts of the Southern Wild. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I'm doing this out of order. Upper right is Jennifer Lawrence's first feature film, a wonderful film called Winter's Bone, about a teenager trying to survive in Appalachia and trying to keep her younger two siblings from starving. Both of her parents, her mother's gone crazy and her father's disappeared. And in the center is Jennifer Lawrence again in the first of the Hunger Games movies. These movies are obviously not all on a par with each other in terms of quality. Crouching Tiger is kind of a masterpiece, and several others of these are as well, but Hunger Games and the Divergent series, which I've included, are perhaps not as great, but I think significant in terms of the female characters. But what really got me started on all this... Oh, two new ones I wanted to add. Hilary Swank's movie The Homesman, it was directed by Tommy Lee Jones in 2014. So I keep adding them to the list. So these are some of the more recent ones. And the Divergent trilogy, it's a quaternity, it's not a trilogy. The last one hasn't come out yet, but the first, so Divergent, Insurgent, and Allegiant 1. Allegiant 2 will be coming out. So those are the new additions to the group. And what got started, couple really got me started on all this was when I had a baby at the age of 39 and realized, I began reading about heroes because it seemed to me a rather heroic undertaking, more than I had anticipated. And I started reading Joseph Campbell and was really horrified that there are absolutely no women mentioned, divine or mortal, in the entire book. In fact, he says in the introduction, everywhere the really creative acts are represented as those deriving from some sort of dying to the world and what happens in the interval of the hero's non-entity, so that he comes back as one reborn, made great, and filled with creative power. That's Campbell. Or in the case of mothers, to whom that applies, maybe not made great, but just utterly exhausted and full of love. And it really does seem to me that mothers, what mothers, and also to some extent fathers and whoever is there as the primary caretakers, really do go through a lot of stages of the hero's journey in that process. It's ordinary heroism because every woman goes through it, especially at the outset. And interestingly, Artemis, the great Amazonian goddess, was also a protector of women in childbirth. And two of her epithets, she actually protected women before birth, Artemis Omnius, she was called, in that aspect, and also Artemis Aletheia, who brings relief in labor, because supposedly she assisted her mother in giving birth to her twin, the one who came right after her, Apollo. And the upper right image, that beautiful young woman is my niece, with her baby who's now 3 months old. And the thing about the heroism of motherhood is that it just keeps going, really. And then if it keeps going, it sometimes reverses itself, and the child can end up taking care of the mother in a heroic way. This is my cousin and my dearest aunt, who's now 98, on my most recent visit with her. So, according to Jung and Campbell, who both wrote very notably, of course, on heroes and heroism, but also Karenyi and Auden and Graves and the other guys who wrote about heroes, this is who they are. They're all men, and they're all, for the most part, warrior heroes. There's Jonah, Beowulf, and Achilles, and who else? St. George by Raphael, and Odysseus in the bottom row. And here is who the heroes are not. Everybody else, everybody. The female heroes. I'll come back to Xena again, but she's kind of a great character, but I don't include her in my group because I think there was a whole group of films and she was on television, you know, who were, I think of them as the warrior babes, but I'll differentiate those in a minute. But girls and elders are not considered to be heroic. Neither are GBLTQ people, transgender people, you name it. Radicals, anarchists, they're not included in any of the writing, except some very few books that have come out. One of which is by two professors of comparative literature who wrote a book called The Female Hero in American and British Literature. That's one of the very few books that I will cite. So, in Jung's view, the hero represents our ego's continuous longings and searches, as well as the longing of the unconscious for consciousness, the longing of the psyche itself for consciousness. That's a particularly important idea of Jung's that is a very relevant one. I criticize him for, you know, his rather dated representation of heroes, but his ideas about heroism were profound and lasting, important. Jung wrote, "He is first and foremost a self-representation of the longing of consciousness, of the longing of the unconscious, of its unquenched and unquenchable desire for the light of consciousness." That's from Collected Works, Volume 5. Theseus, that's a previous image was of, I said it was Achilles, but it was Theseus. So Campbell wrote, "The hero is the man or woman who has been able to battle past personal and local historical limitations." This is what he says in the introduction. "A man or woman has been able to battle past personal and local historical limitations to the generally valid, normally human forms." But then he never mentions women as heroes again in the entire 391 pages of the book, which I started reading when I was nursing my daughter, and the book ended up in the wastebasket more than once. So according to Pearson and Pope, the two professors of comparative literature, an exploration of the heroic journeys of women and of men who are relatively powerless because of class or race makes clear that the archetypal hero masters the world by understanding it, not by dominating, controlling, or owning the world and other people. And they don't talk about aging heroes, but it's something that's more of an interest of mine now than when I first began being interested in female heroes, and it's certainly a deepening of understanding, but one that isn't viewed as heroic. So, and again, here's especially here people who are not thought of as heroes. It's a gay couple, one caretaking the other. So, no review of the hero and of the rest of the talk. I'll talk a bit more about the basic characteristics of the hero, both male and female, and the basic pattern of the hero's journey, and then get into the films, the female heroes in recent cinema, and then we'll be able to have some discussion and questions at the end. So, your basic hero, and the basic pattern, drunken Heracles, Hercules. And at the bottom, that painting is, I'll come back to that painting again, that's a painting of Eros, Amor and Psyche, the myth of Amor and Psyche, which is arguably a myth about a female hero, Psyche that is, and that was written about very beautifully by Eric Nolan, who otherwise I'm not a big fan of, but he wrote a great book about that myth. So the basic pattern, and about the archetype of the hero. It's the best known myth in the world, and of course it's also an archetype, which is a tricky word with which most of you are, I'm sure, well acquainted, but it always is worth maybe talking about a little bit. I think of it as a kind of, almost like a mold into which human experience keeps getting filled, poured and filled, a little bit like Plato's idea of eidos, or divine ideal form. So they're the figures that keep turning up in different forms all over the world throughout history and different cultures, heroes being a prime example. Stories about heroes represent our basic need to strengthen our egos and establish ourselves in the world and become our true selves, and it takes agency to do that. So it's more associated with the first half of life. Heroism in youth is about growing up, leaving behind the protection of parents, and setting out into the world. Heroes at other points in life arise to question and overthrow personal and collective values and beliefs that have gone static. Heroes often have to suffer greatly and sometimes die in order to be reborn, either metaphorically or literally, actually. And they go through initiations and they go on journeys. And as archetypal, mythical, and historical figures, they serve to inspire us. So the basic pattern, heroes hold and withstand the tension of opposites. That's an idea of Jung's, and it's an important idea. And that's part of what's inspiring about them. And you really see that in these films. I'll talk more about that, with the way that these young women do that, embody that. The adventures of the hero are rites of passage. So the hero sets forth from the common world. He or she encounters fabulous forces. Battles are fought, usually trials and tribulations are endured, tasks are accomplished, and the hero returns with some boon or treasure to share with her community, society, or humankind. And that's a description of, that's Joseph, based on Joseph Henderson's writing on the hero, and that fits well the warrior heroes. Doesn't fit so well some other kinds of heroes, but it's a basic description of the adventuring hero. And in terms of mothers, it's certainly a rite of passage and a setting forth from the common world, although mothers remain within the known world. It's not so much that we encounter fabulous forces or fight battles, but the trials and tribulations of pregnancy and labor and raising infants is pretty extreme, and a lot of tasks have to be accomplished. And the boon that you come back with is pretty spectacular, having a new human being come into the world through you. So, an alternative scheme that's proposed by Pearson and Pope, which I like, is that in three stages, the female hero or non-white male hero learns to trust her own authority after authorities fail her. In the second stage, she recognizes that the qualities she believed were masculine are hers too. And in the third stage, she learns that these human heroic qualities can be seen within a female tradition. So the standard hero's journey as described by Eamon Campbell, is basically separation, initiation, and return. The male or female hero sets off, intentionally or unintentionally, on a series of adventures that take her beyond the boundaries of the safe and familiar, often in order to discover something that's been lost. During the journey, courage and sacrifice are required, and the hero is stretched beyond her capacity. Her range of spiritual and soulful experience is greatly expanded, and she returns with a message about that experience. And in the case of motherhood, it's more returning with a being than a message, but often the hero is subjected to further trials, tests, or ordeals to make sure she's really a hero. Very true of motherhood and of parenting. Go on for the rest of your life. The hero's journey or quest is usually a cycle, a going and returning from a depth, height, or distance, during which transformation occurs because the hero stops thinking about herself and her own self-preservation. That's important, I think. That putting aside of one's own concerns and selflessness, even with the most egotistical or and powerful male heroes, that's a characteristic of the real hero's journey. In other words, her relationship to her ego is altered, and her consciousness is expanded, his or her consciousness, as a result. And this is true of motherhood and fatherhood too, when it's entered into deeply. For Jung, the real adventure is the exploration of the unconscious, and the goal is a relationship with the guiding center or self. The hero's journey is the drama of the human being's development toward wholeness. However, Jung's writing on the hero also contains the assumption that the hero is male and subject, while the female is object. So the basic pattern of the hero's journey, that's Hercules, Heracles, slaying the Lernaean Hydra, which was his second labor. So usually the hero has a humble birth, superhuman strength, a rapid rise to power. The male heroes usually have a fallibility to hubris or pride. They have often a fall, some kind of fall through the trail, often through the trail, and heroic sacrifice, which can end in death. They get help. They often get help from gods or guardians or magical helping creatures, as is the case in fairy tales. And they often have to face monsters or dragons or evil forces and engage in triumphant struggles with them. That's from Joseph Henderson. So an alternate schema, and the images I chose represent alternatives to what I've just described. So Rosa Parks, obviously, on the upper left, who's a great hero of mine, partook in a movement that was inspired, you know, the nonviolence of the civil rights movement, was learned from Gandhi and Gandhi's techniques. It's so radical, still incredibly radical, the nonviolence that they were committed to. And below her, Jonah, inside the whale, in a painting by a self-taught artist from Alabama, Annie Lucas. And Jonah is a great example of a hero who, he's just getting carried along. So it's a more less active, less warrior-like adventure that he's on. He just has to wait around hoping to fight his way out, which he does. And on the right, that same painting of Amor and Psyche by Orazio Gentileschi. So the alternate schema, the hero might have, and this is true of all the women heroes in the female heroes in the films, come from normal or humble birth, and intelligence and intuition is usually more notable than strength, although these women fully occupy their physicality. There's a valiant struggle with evil, but it's not necessarily successful. In other words, there's a preponderance of tragic heroes in these films. Their self-doubt and a humble attitude is much more prominent than pride in these women, but self-pity is a danger. That's something that Norman pointed out in his book on Norman's psyche. If pride is present, though, it can be very stubborn and willful. So in traditional Jungian language, the more historical of the female heroes in the films are autonomous possessed. They're absolutely stubborn, and the men just want to kill them for it. True Grit and The Homesman are both examples of that. Those are the two films that are set the furthest back historically. So the women who are the most in the most repressed and difficult environments are the most kind of imitative of masculine attitudes, you might say, or possessed by them. Betrayal does happen, as well as numerous setbacks for these women, and sacrifice in ending in death can occur. Help from gods or guardians or magical creatures is often missing, and their effort to maintain relatedness and relationship is very prominent, and the effort to sustain bonds and deepen them is present in the female heroes. And we have Carol Gilligan to thank for her observations on that, how intrinsically that's, I mean, she believed, and I think she was right, that there's, we're kind of hardwired, women are more hardwired, we're more intrinsically oriented that way. And it shows up in these films. I just wanted to add this picture of Judith beheading Holofernes, because it's done by Artemisia Gentileschi, who's the daughter of the man who painted the painting of Amor and Psyche. And they were painted not far apart in time, just about 20 years, less than 20 years apart. It's a powerful painting. Painted in between 1620 and 1621. She was influenced by Caravaggio, of course. So, the classic female hero is often a warrior or a wanderer. Eleanor of Aquitaine, Joan of Arc is the prime example of the warrior type of hero, and Eleanor of Aquitaine, but Mirabai, the Hindu saint, was a great example of a wandering hero. I'm going to focus, of course, more on mythological heroes and cinematic ones than on historical actual women. But these three women, of course, as we know, really lived. So, other possibilities besides warriors, the movies tend to feature warrior heroes, and also these new women heroes who are showing up, female heroes in television, they tend to be warriors. But of course, there are women who are heroic wanderers, also heroic innocents like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, martyrs and activists, and Malala being one of our great contemporary martyrs. Also, heroes who are artists, they're heroic because of their artistic innovation and adventuresomeness. Virginia Woolf being one of my great heroes. There's Mirabai again, the Hindu saint, who was a wandering hero, and Erin Brockovich being a great activist hero, as depicted there by Julia Roberts. The wise, the sage, embodied by Professor McGonagall, magician, sage. I mean, obviously these categories combine and overlap. Dorothy being, you know, in Wizard of Oz being an innocent wanderer, for example, and Harry, Sojourner Truth on the upper left. The hero, as described by and delineated by Jung and Campbell, was basically the warrior as well as the wanderer. Jung wrote, "Heroes are usually wanderers, and wandering is a symbol of longing, that restless urge in all of us which never finds an object. Heroes are like the wandering sun, and thus the hero myth is solar. Certainly, there are many mythological as well as historical women who've been classic warrior heroes, but not all of them are warriors or wanderers, and women may live up to and live out the warrior model successfully, sometimes at great cost, as we'll see in the films that I'm going to talk about.
Sarah, can you name the three on the other slide, the three women on the lower right corner?
Three women in the lower right corner.
Well, the three slides.
Above.
The three pictures. So the two women above and then the woman on the stretcher.
So that's Edith. Yeah. I'm sorry, what is her last name? The Dunlop. That's right, I have it here. Winslow?
Winslow.
That's her coming out after the winning in the Supreme Court, her Supreme Court case, overturning the Doma law.
Who's in the center?
Center is Maggie Smith playing Professor McGonagall in Harry Potter. Malala is the lower right. Virginia Woolf is to the left of Malala. Left-hand corner is Mirabai, the wandering Miss Hindu poet and musician and saint. And then, of course, above her, Erin Brockovich, the real Erin Brockovich to the right of Julia Roberts. Sojourner Truth in the upper left of Wonder Woman. And, of course, Dorothy. So, I think that arguably cinema is our contemporary mythology, and movie stars have become our mythic heroes. I prefer not to use the word heroine because of the homonym, the unfortunate homonym, and also because I don't think it needs to be agendered now. That's Brad Pitt as Achilles. And also, you know, we project them literally. They're still projected at large, and we project onto them, onto our movie stars, as if they were in constellations above us. Something that I came across recently, although it was in a it appeared in a comic strip in 1985, is something referred to still by film historians as Bechdel's Law, and that's in the comic strip Two Dykes to Watch Out For, or just Dykes to Watch Out For, it's called. So one of them is explaining to the other the rule, which most of the films that I that are in my group meet the requirements of Bechdel's Law, but a lot of films do not. So one of the women is explaining that to the other, that she only goes to movies that satisfy those three requirements. They have to have at least two women in the film, and they have to talk to each other about something besides a man. It's amazing how few movies actually meet that requirement.
Well, what's the third?
Yeah, what is the third?
Has to have a name.
Thank you. That's a good one. Yes. These were the predecessors of the female heroes that I'm going to talk about, but they don't really cut it because they really were functioning as sex objects, at the same time that they were pretending to wield weapons and be heroic. Xena was pretty hardcore, but the others not so much. It certainly was not Jane Fonda's finest moment in Barbara. And I am an admirer of Uma Thurman, but not so much in Kill Bill. And Wonder Woman, I prefer the cartoon to the TV show. So to come back to this group of films, the initial group. So there's six women and two girls. Interestingly, most of them were motherless, half of them fatherless, and all quite tragic in one way or another. So that the girl, young woman with the axe, that's Winter's Bone, and she's really trying to survive and keep her siblings alive. There is Jennifer Lawrence again in Hunger Games, just above her. And in the center there, the little girl is the main character in Beasts of the Southern Wild, who's also trying to survive in a kind of post-environment, you know, situation of environmental breakdown and just slightly in the future. She's motherless. The woman on the upper right is in the movie Incendie. There she is caught in the Lebanese Civil War. She's Christian. And below, the two women in Crouching Tiger. And to their left, the main character in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is the Swedish trilogy. Pretty horrible, pretty violent. But she's an amazing hero. She's also the only queer hero in this initial group of films. And lower left is Hailee Steinfeld as the actor in True Grit, the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit. So, when these women and girls pick up weapons, this isn't true in all the films, especially not so much in the Divergent series that I'll come to, the newest of the films, where there's a lot of shooting and a lot of violence. But one of the things that's striking in these films is that these women, when they pick up guns, they seem to really register the import, the weightiness of what they're doing with them. On the upper left, Jennifer Lawrence's character is teaching her two younger siblings how to hunt so that they might be able to survive if something happens to her. And she doesn't shoot otherwise in the film. To the right is, again, the film Incendie. And that character becomes, enters a kind of dissociative state, actually, because she's so traumatized by what's going on. You can see that in her face. And that's the only time she picks up a gun in that film. And below is True Grit, where she's aiming at the bad guy. So, to go back again to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was the first, it's the only one in which, the only film in the group which has two really remarkable female heroes. It has a beautiful symmetry to the plot because there are also two men, the older man who's the martial arts teacher and the younger man who's the bandit who she's chasing in that first scene that I played. There is romance in this film, as we know, but it's secondary to the drama, I think, and to the tragedy of it. And there's a wonderful moment in the little smallest of the images on the upper right-hand corner when the older man, who's a martial arts master, encounters the young woman. She's actually stolen his sword, and that's what initiates the action in the beginning of the story. And he really wants her to become his pupil, he wants to teach her, and she's very hot-headed, and she has a female teacher who's a criminal, and she's a fabulous martial artist, but she lacks a bit in discipline, and they have an encounter. I don't know if you remember it. It's at a waterfall, and it's not just that he wants his sword back. He really wants to connect with her and wants to teach her, and has something to teach her, but and she wants to learn from him. And there's this beautiful scene shot of her face. He tells her he's a little condescending. He's a Chinese guy, you know, but in the whatever it is, 18th century. But she wants that knowledge, but she can't stand to be subservient to anybody. So she flings the sword into the waterfall and dives after it. She won't be a student, but it's a beautiful moment in the film. And then the film True Grit. There's a great scene in the beginning. How many have seen that film? It's worth seeing, although there's a terrible, sad injury to the horse. So that's a spoiler alert, but it's really quite a terrible part. But she sets out after... She's trying to find her father's killer, which is true of Winter's Bone also. That the action of the film surrounds that quest, a hero's quest to find justice, to find out who killed her father and where he is. And she tries to enlist help of two men who just blow her off. She's only 14 years old. And she goes after them. It's a similar kind of energy to the scene in Crouching Tiger. She won't give up. She won't take no for an answer. She literally goes after them on her horse, and she has to cross a river. So it's near the beginning of the film, and it's the classic beginning of the hero's journey. The hero often has to ford a river or a body of water before beginning on the road of trials, which is really what she begins on. And she has very grudging help from these two men. She meets with a bitter end. That's her in her adult state at the end of the film, which I think reflects again her position as a hero at the historically her period at the very beginning of the 20th century. 1903 is when the book was set that the movie is based on. So she ends up quite bitter, quite embittered, and injured, and traumatized. In Winter's Bone, again, very much worth seeing. Jennifer Lawrence has gone on to do so many things, but she's really great in this film. She's searching for this missing father and just trying to survive. And in this film, I was really struck by the fact that here's this beautiful young woman, she has a beautiful friend as well, who never takes her coat off. True Grit also, it's cold throughout these two movies. They never undress past their coat and hardly change clothes at all, which I think is a wonderful kind of reversal of the way things have gone for beautiful young women in films for since the beginning of films. Incendie, also a very difficult film to watch. And she's very, very traumatized by what happens to her, and it's depicted heart-wrenchingly. But it's a tragedy on an epic level, like a Greek tragedy. It's really worth seeing. She sets her children. She has twin adult children, a girl and a boy, young man, young woman, and she sets them on the quest. To go find their missing father. So that's the center of the dramatic action in that film. And then she's seen in flashback in the Civil War of what she went through is gradually revealed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you said that often the hero has to ford a body of water,
mm-hmm.
do you think that symbolically, in terms of the individuation process, that has meaning?
Absolutely.
Well,
often the bodies of water are often associated with the unconscious, with the psyche. So it could be understood that way as, you know, having to, in order to strengthen the ego, having to cross into, to get across, to traverse the psyche. You know, and the obstacles and the unknown, to really go into the unknown deeply, which I think is part of what oceans especially represent for us. But often the heroes are fording a river. It's curious. So that's more often very challenging, but somewhat more manageable to the ego in a sense. And that's often at the outset. Do you have any further thoughts about that?
Well, in balcony. It's a Lucio.
Saluzio, yeah.
Lucio.
There's purification to it also. Yeah, it's a good point. It's a very good point. In the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy, so those are the three titles, she is also a very traumatized woman, and that's very obvious in her character. She's been very badly abused by her father and her legal guardian, and she gets a remarkable revenge, which is really quite something to see. One of the things I love about these films, again, very difficult to watch, but worth it for me, at least, her colleague, Michael, he's called Michael Blomqvist in the movie, the one who's behind her on her motorcycle, he's a journalist, and she's they're working together to do a big expose of corruption, and he's the much more receptive and, in a sense, more feminine of the two. She seems to embody the masculine in a wonderful, sort of queered, powerful, feminine way. And yet he has feminine qualities because he's more receptive. And there's a wonderful love scene, love-making sex scene in that. I can't remember, I think it's the first one, but it might be the second, where she suddenly jumps into bed with him to his surprise. And he's the one who's more connected emotionally to her, and she kind of just jumps away from him after they've made love. It's an interesting scene, interesting reversal of the way things often are depicted in cinema. Hunger Games is not one of the great trilogies in my group of films, but I think it's an important, it's been widely read and widely watched by young people. One of the things that is important about it, I think, is that the young men and women are absolutely on equal footing as warriors in this terrible gladiator-like arena that they're forced into to fight against each other. So they're equally victimized by the repressive regime, but they fight with each other, but also help each other very, very much on equal footing in a way that's somewhat new in film, or was at the time that these came out. And it's rather striking that Jennifer Lawrence in Hunger Games, those images were widely advertised, and you saw them everywhere for a while, and then the Pixar movie Brave imitated the Hunger Games image, but they were all both, I think, appropriating the images of Artemis with her bow. Also, the Roman, you know, she became Diana, the huntress in she's often referred to as Diana, but it's Artemis, a hunter, and fierce Amazon warrior type, who is being emulated and imitated or emulated. Beast of the Southern Wild, it's a wonderful film. It doesn't really fit quite with this other group. She's not really a warrior. She's really just trying to survive. She's very young. She's motherless. She's searching for a mother, hopelessly, fruitlessly. And it has a very dysfunctional father, although he's quite wonderful, wonderful character.
She goes on a journey.
She sure does. Yeah. The Homesman is a very tragic film. Also tragic because of the period in which it's set, similar to True Grit, but even a little further back, about a woman trying to survive out on the as a pioneer in the prairies, and she volunteers because no man in her settlement will do so. She steps up and volunteers to take three women who have gone insane because of the stress and the trauma and the hardship. They've just had breakdowns, and she volunteers to take them back to their families, who are in Idaho, I think. And it's a terrible travail and journey. And she gets very grudging, very insufficient help from the men whom she meets with along the way. And Haley Steinfeld, who was in True Grit, appears briefly in that movie, as does Meryl Streep and her daughter. Her daughter, Mamie, is one of the crazy women. So then the Divergent trilogy, or Quaternity, three of them have come out, which I think are valuable. They're not great movies, but they're valuable because it shows how this is really coming now into the popular culture, these changing views of women and roles of women. So this is the first one in 2014. And I believe that this woman is Polly Perrette from NCIS, although I've been having an argument about that with my partner. Insurgent is the second in the series, and there's a real psychological development in this character, these characters, which takes place as a little bit like Harry Potter. I mean, you see her getting older, the main character, played by Shameen Woodley, and they really struggle. They're not having an easy time of it, physically or psychologically or emotionally. In the second film, in Insurgent, the kind of villainous leader is played by Kate Winslet. So there are women who are bad guys, bad foes for these women, young female heroes have female foes sometimes. And the most terrible torture and obstacles which she has to overcome are actually induced by a hallucinogenic drug in a kind of a torture chamber. So the torture is all happening inside of her, and she's hallucinating it. And it's a very striking scene. So that's her sort of hanging from those cables. But then she's hallucinating, breaking through the glass, and many other things that happen to her on that sort of trip. It's also a trial that she has to try to survive, and does. And then Allegiant, the most recent this year. I'm not sure these films are getting better. I don't know what the last one's going to be like. But they're worth seeing. So this whole troop is going out, this gang of five warriors together against, in this case, the leader is now a guy, the bad guy. And then I wanted to just end with, I now in my late age here, I have finally started watching television, something I never did before, and I have a favorite program even, which is NCIS, me and most of the rest of the United States, apparently, and NCIS, both LA and the original one. And the thing that I like about it are the women characters. You know, they're really quite remarkable women and remarkable men working side by side as teams. And some of the teams, you know, as those of you know who watch it, some of the teams are two men, some are a man and a woman. I don't think there are any women, there are two women together. No, there are no teams of two women. But the women characters in this are in both NCIS and NCIS LA are remarkable, very intelligent. They even speak foreign languages. A couple of them are fighters. A couple of them are heroic for their forensic abilities. And then the one of the directors, played by Linda Hunt in the upper right, Hetty, the character Hetty, who has been, of course, a fighter, is now more just trying to keep everybody, take care of her teams and make sure that everybody's doing what they need to do. She's a remarkable director. So one of the questions that it's raising for me is the violence I know that's part of these shows and part of a number of the movies. And it's a troubling thing to me that these women are so heroic, but they're having to engage in violence as warriors alongside men. I mean, of course, that's gripping. It makes for drama. But it's also, you know, that's not what makes the world change in a better way. And so it just raises questions for me about, you know, the way things are headed. We seem to be a very aggressive species, and we don't seem to be able to give that up. But as women participate more fully in that, in characters at least, in our contemporary mythology, it raises questions about, you know, whether that should be glorified as it continues to be, or are we going to have better alternatives to that that are as interesting, as powerful to watch? Yeah, so it's time for questions and any comments.
Seems to me, Sarah, that the thread you are pursuing is that the women are moving more into consciousness as opposed to residing more in the unconscious. So in some sense, they're moving more toward a kind of rationalism. In what way is that changing the nature of womanhood?
Well, I think that question contains some assumption about women having been unconscious. Are you talking about the way women were depicted by men, or the way women actually lived their lives?
I'm talking about, since you've done this fundamentally through film, that has occurred through film. So some of it is a parallel of actual situations, but
right.
In most cases, it is fictional.
Yes.
However, does that not parallel the shift in the culture?
Well, yeah, I think it does, in the sense that women are being perceived as being more rational and more conscious, but I think they were always rational and conscious. It's just that the culture is catching up and depicting them differently. I mean, how long has it taken us, you know?
The comment isn't about saying that they weren't capable of being rational and were often rational. That's
right.
Not what the comment was about.
It's about the way they're depicted in film, which is changing. That's true.
But the question is going whether there is a shift going on, period, in the nature of womanhood or femaleness.
Are we becoming more rational?
No. Beginning to lose more touch with the unconscious, ergo possibly the more nurturing aspect.
Oh, well, you have to be conscious to be in touch with the unconscious. If you're unconscious, then you're just in the unconscious, and that isn't being in touch with, you know, with yourself, really. And I think that, instinctually, women are more nurturers, that's true.
Be careful. There's a difference between conscious and self-conscious. They're not the same thing. Consciousness is response more to the external, but not necessarily the reflection of yourself on the fact that you are dealing with the external.
I'm not sure I agree, but I'm curious what other people think. I think consciousness and self-consciousness are kind of indivisible, actually. Yeah.
I'm
curious what your...
Oh, sorry, I'll come back. Yeah, go ahead there. And
I'm sorry. What your thoughts and responses are, Sarah, to the recent news item and decision of the military to now allow women to be fully involved in immediate combat, and these two women that went through the training of special operations, I believe it was, and clearly were at least as competent as any of the men. In some ways, it seems to me it is very much in tune with a progression that's taking place in the culture. I try to imagine myself, having been in infantry combat so many years ago, imagining what it would be like to have a woman combat soldier next to me, both of us firing our rifles or machine guns or bazookas. It definitely blows my mind in a certain sense. I mean, it's such a new breakthrough or image.
But you know, it isn't so new, really. You know, women have always taken up arms in struggles without much visibility.
Yeah.
I mean, think of, you know, in Nicaragua, during the revolution, the Sandinistas, many women were fighting there. I mean, that's not long ago.
And but Israel also.
But historically, you know, the Civil War, I mean, it goes back quite a way. And I feel very torn about it. You know, it's very much in keeping with what's happening with these women characters, what I'm seeing in these films, which I find exhilarating and amazing, and CIS is full of that. And at the same time, it makes me a little heartsick, you know, that any human beings, that so many human beings are doing that, male and female. And I'm going to go first to you, and then
a couple things. One, I really like the point that you brought up at the end about must this depiction be violent? There's intellectual challenges, physical challenges, many kinds of challenges that a hero can face that don't involve shooting, killing, guns, and so making women go by that model that men have also been forced to go by, I think it's not the way to envision a more just and equal, peaceful world. So it would be nice to see a utopian vision versus a dystopian vision that was still dramatic and entertaining.
Well, that's the thing. How, you know, can it be as dramatic and as entertaining? We seem very fixated on violence as as an aspect of entertainment, and that's a very troubling thing.
I agree, and I think about that a lot. Because there's still drama in life. I mean, we don't have shooting in our life, and it's quite dramatic. So.
Right. Absolutely.
And the other thing was, I'm curious if you've seen any of the Lara Croft movies?
No, I haven't.
Because she was the first hero or action hero that I became aware of. Maybe around Crouching Tiger, Time. You might like them.
Are they called that? I mean, they have her name in it?
Lara Croft, Tomb Raider.
Oh, Tomb Raider.
With Angelina Jolie. And I think there's two or three of them.
Thanks. Yeah.
So, pursuing, you know, what that would look like to have this strength and sort of this animus that wasn't violent. And my first thought was, these women who were engaged in these violent episodes that were, you know, are their children at home? You know, are their children, or is there a maternal side And then I was thinking about the move, the films that are, and a number of animated films that have these heroic figures who are children,
mm-hmm.
who seem to, that maybe there's some information in those characters that, you know, have qualities that aren't, you know, like off the charts, dark, but there are other skills that are used that have, you know, this animus quality.
Well, Harry Potter, the Harry Potter, you know, that's part of what, there's some violence, you know, certainly some engagement in that way, but the presence of magic, the magical, I think, you know, and they're not, they start out almost as children, latency age, and they go into adolescence, of course, but, you know, we have, it's true, we have some great child heroes who have some resemblance to the female heroes, mm-hmm. especially in being orphans or parentless or almost parentless. I'm sorry. That I think that's a feature that they share, and it accentuates their autonomy and their individuality. The fact that they're parentless. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking?
Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Yep, she's another one. There are many, many orphaned child heroes. Yeah, Penny, and then Judy.
I was recently studying the sculptress, Glenda Goodacre, who did the Vietnam Women's Memorial. There was no memorial for the women nurses
mm-hmm.
who...
She did one of the memorials.
One of them.
Yeah.
And it's... the depiction is the nurses,
mm-hmm.
but they're caring for each other, which was phenomenal.
Mm.
And that they got together and funded the memorial.
Ah.
So, and that group is still functioning. The other point I wanted to make was that the Dragon Tattoo actress, Bruno Mari, I think,
mm-hmm.
was in the movie Carol. About the lesbian
yeah,
couple.
But that's the American version of Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Rooney Mara
oh,
was
right,
in the American
right.
one, not the Swedish one.
Right.
Yes, and she's in the movie Carol. That's right.
Just in terms of her taking a very different role.
Yes. Wonderful actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to add, for me, the film The Danish Girl,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that her journey was... completely heroic
uh-huh.
and was not she wasn't so I've been wondering about the violence because the for her body had to go through as she came she changed her body and was transgendered and
uh-huh.
was moving from the male body to female body, that was, I mean, I don't know if you say that's violent, it's hard on her body, but she was not, anyway, in terms of cinematic depictions of female heroes,
mm.
she's not shooting or killing or
mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen that, I'll have to watch
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
The preview was so horrible, I couldn't bear to watch it. It was such a sappy preview, but
oh, it's
to look beyond that. It was good fun.
In line with that comment, how does Caitlyn Jenner fit within this framework? That is what you're grappling with. Caitlyn Jenner, who is this great athlete, then turns into a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, is at the highlight of focusing on the issues
mm-hmm.
of being. So I wonder how you would position Caitlyn Jenner within what you're dealing with here.
Well, she's not the first. I mean, there have been other athletes who've gone through gender transitions And it's a very heroic thing to do, especially for somebody who is in a position of prominence, to go through that process and then, you know, re-identify themselves in that way. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'll get to the back.
It's an interesting thing to me. I'm wondering if the violence that concerns me, how things are trending. I know that Starhawk, are you familiar with her, The Fifth Sacred Thing? It's a book. But it's almost, to me, like nonviolence coming up against violence. It's almost like this is the media machine using women again, because violence sells, right? So it seems like what this other woman said over here, that if there was a, it seems like the real good versus evil would be nonviolence versus violence. And in Starhawk's Fifth Sacred Thing, it was a utopia vision that's forced on these people who are trying a different way because of the downfall of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a forward-looking book, like, you know, about the times we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Oil and, you know, politics. But so it's interesting to me that it's almost like, I love watching strong women do these things too, but it's very much like that strength is being co-opted, right, by a violent, violent mold. That it's like, are they really heroes, or are they just being sold? You know?
Well, they're doing what heroes have always done. You know, and that's not just, I think, something that's being promulgated by the entertainment industry. It's what human beings are doing and have always done, unfortunately, in the world, which is fight with each other, defend their territory, defend their possessions, defend their beliefs, and fight over it. And that's not, that does seem to be, unfortunately, quite innate. It's ubiquitous. It's not, we don't all behave like that, thank goodness, but it's a deep instinct in us that keeps on, talk about an archetype, you know, keeps on manifesting itself. And it will be interesting to see if there are some heroes who turn up who are compelling and beautifully depicted, who are nonviolent, heroically nonviolent, perhaps coming up against forces of violent opposition, you know, in film. I can't say that I've seen that, but it seems possible. And I'm going to go to the...
You see it in life.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Gandhi, you know, being... And the civil rights movement being part of that. Can go to the back. Yes.
You go this to the beginning of the 12 traditional heroes, which included help from the divine being.
Yeah.
And then you had qualities of, and what I understand is qualities of alternative heroes, and said there was no help from the divine.
Tended not to be.
And what, were you basing that on your study of the films, or was that throughout history?
Oh, no. In these films.
Okay.
I mean, think of fairy tales, which are, you know, a kind of, they're part of our mythology also. They are myths, or a different kind of, you know, mythic story. Women got, and girls got help from magical beings, from animals, from, you know, godmothers and little people and all kinds of people would turn up to help in fairy tales. So that's been very prevalent.
And also in the traditional hero's journey, there were divine helpers.
Yes, often there were for the men, but they're not turning up for these women.
What do you make of that?
Well, we don't have... David, maybe you could say something about that in terms of the realm of fantasy fiction, where there's more magical elements. In these films, there's not... There just aren't divine figures showing up, really. But in contemporary fantasy fiction, which is a little bit closer to fairy tale, I think, in a sense, of magical, not necessarily divine, but magical energies and elements enter in. Are there helpers? Are there helpful figures who turn up? Yes. Right? Yeah. So maybe we're not seeing it in major motion pictures, but I think it's present in the culture and it's coming through in other... I mean, I think that's part of why we love the Harry Potter books and the films. It's very much there, alive and well, as it is in our dreams and in our psyches, you know, in our lives. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing up motherhood, pregnancy, and labor, and nursing, and the incredible heroic work of being a mother. I had two of my two children during my analytic training.
Wow.
Which actually grounded me in a very different way, and I discovered the secret of the power in a woman in labor. It was unbelievable.
Well,
it's Olympian.
It is, and it's also, it brings you, you know, talk about thresholds. It brings you right to the threshold between life and death. To me, it felt like dying and didn't feel Olympian at all. But I do notice, though, since that time, you know, when I began to get interested in female heroes because of having a baby, that the young men whom I've seen beginning to be primary caretakers for their babies are really doing pretty much, you know, they don't give birth, but everything else, and are going through all of that and really showing up in a way that I never thought possible. It's very moving. You know, young men now in their 20s and 30s and older than that too, of course, who are doing that. It's really quite extraordinary. So it's a whole shift that's happening there. Anita, we'll make it work.
I've always thought there was a fierceness about a woman that men maybe didn't have, especially when a child, particularly a child of hers, was in danger.
Yeah.
I mean, that fierceness I could feel inside myself.
Yeah.
It's very different from fighting in a war.
Yes.
As a warrior and shooting at people you have no connection to.
Yes, which is, you could say that in a sense, that kind of fighting, the fighting that really is most of what military warfare is about, not so much terrorist warfare, but military, where people are removed from their targets, they can't even draw on the instinctual, you know, in those situations, and they talk about it, and that's part of why the PTSD is so terrible. It's because they're separated in a sense from what they're doing. And I agree with you about the ferociousness that's in women. I think it's in fathers protecting
too. I imagine it is. Now, I have no problem with, if a woman is a real warrior, having a place that she can go into the military and live that side of herself out. It's not for me, but for other women it may be.
Yeah, and it may be partly fueled by testosterone, you know, which we all have, which helps, you know, helps us to really push, you know, mobilize ourselves physically in that way. And women weren't perceived as being that way, but clearly we're capable of it, given the predilection or under certain circumstances. Yeah. Here.
speaking as someone who recently arrived at the age of 90, one of the things I'm struck by is we are discussing really basically life up to about 60, maybe.
Yeah.
But Nita and I have, we no longer have first half of life and second half of life. We have third half of life. And that is going to increase. I was just reading an article the other day that half of the babies born today will live to be 100 years old.
Wow.
So the issue that I'm sitting with here is I'm really entranced by what you presented, but I'm asking myself, how does the heroic show up when you get to be late 60s, 70s,
80s? That's a great question. That's a really great question.
And one of my personal heroes for so many years has been Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. I just felt that she was one of the groundbreakers of speaking the truth passionately from a feminine orientation with a sense of confidence and authority. I'm fascinated with Elizabeth Warren, who it seems to me is, and Hillary Clinton is 68 years old. Running for president takes a lot of chutzpah and a lot of courage.
Well, how old is Bernie Sanders? He's in his 70s.
He's in his 70s, right?
74.
Is he?
Right.
Yeah.
And so I've been sitting here, what is courage, heroism, leadership look like when you get to be in your 70s and your 80s? The best I can come to, drawing to a certain extent on my own journey. I mean, I was an infantry soldier at 18, and then I had other leadership roles. I think it is drawing upon a source of experiential wisdom and saying it like it is, and not any longer being allied with, I don't know how to put it, one's earlier identifications, I guess is the best I can say, that in Native American tradition, you see this so clearly in terms of the elders, the sage, the medicine man. Mm-hmm. And it gets it obscured, I think, in our culture, and we get focused. We're so youth-oriented. We're so oriented towards really up to age 50 or 55 or 60.
Yeah.
And so this heroic tradition is more military and it's more confrontational.
It's youth-oriented, there's no doubt about it. And as we know, Jung had to confront the death of the hero in his confrontation with the unconscious. The death of Siegfried was deeply traumatic for him, and yet pivotal, absolutely pivotal. And so I think he gave us the model of the understanding, anyway, that the hero it has to be gone through to mobilize the identity and the ego, but then it has to be transcended, and that the second half of life or the third half is more about wisdom, traditions, and deepening of experience, of giving over of ego, allowing it to dissolve, to confront the most heroic thing of all, in a sense, which is death. You know, which our heroes have to confront all the time in these battles, and yet that's what awaits all of us. So the second half of life, if we get to old age, or in whatever way we have to meet death, our death, we usually do it not so gloriously and youthfully as the heroes do, but if we get to get older, we do it very in a way that's unsung. But that's the ultimate that we're preparing for, the ultimate threshold, the ultimate river that we have to cross. Kara.
There's so many ideas. They're wonderful. Just going back and not picking up on the stream of things for a moment before I lose it was just to say I was interested at least in the divergent, what was it, insurgent?
Yeah.
That in her own, that hero, it became clear as she developed that she is multifaceted.
Yes.
And I thought that was really important.
Yeah.
Because before their roles were segmented into smaller categories.
Yeah.
Candor, dauntless,
oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, she embodied having all the categories. And for example, when she, and that related to the question of killing, for example, when it was her turn and she had the opportunity to slit the throat of the woman who was the evil, representing evil,
mm-hmm.
she didn't.
Mm-hmm. Although she engaged in other violence.
She, well,
yeah. And she wasn't from the pacifist clan. She crossed over. As you're saying, and she has different. There's a clan system in these books and films.
But
and
she had several opportunities to kill
mm-hmm.
and chose not to.
Yeah.
And then in other situations, she did kill. This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
This is this character is very multifaceted.
Yeah, she's complex.
And discriminating. In
uh-huh.
one situation, she killed
uh-huh.
against, you know, conflict. In another situation,
good
she
point.
Doesn't. There's a lot of discrimination going
uh-huh.
on here about, or thinking about, when you kill, when you don't kill.
And discrimination's a good word,
yeah.
and it's characteristic of a lot of these female heroes in these films.
Exactly.
They have a lot of discrimination. And they endure tension. The tension, you know,
of
I was talking about the tension of the opposites.
Well, this is a tension of more than the opposite.
Yeah.
And I think the modern person is holding, this is true for the modern person, particularly the modern woman,
mm-hmm.
I think is capable. We are holding multiple opposites.
Yeah.
My artistic picture of that is much more complicated.
Yeah.
So it isn't, Jung is brilliant and has contributed that, but it's more than the opposites now. That's what, either transgender, this, or that.
Well, there are multiple opposites, is another way of saying it. You can't have more than opposites. Opposites are opposites.
No,
but you can have lots of them.
I know, but I believe there's something in a modern time beyond more of another principle, including the opposite,
uh-huh.
but more than that.
Uh-huh.
That will not bring us into an understanding of modern time unless we get thinking that way.
Uh-huh.
But right now, the other thing was that she did have the ability as a hero to unify. So as it progresses, she unifies her group, her gang at the end. It's actually bringing together people from different segments.
Mm-hmm.
People who had chosen different ways are now unified behind her. So I do think there's something about the possibility of unification,
mm-hmm.
you know, these kinds of things. The only other thing I want to say at the moment is around meaningful heroism as an elder. There's a Native American tribe in New Mexico, and the story is that when the grandmother was in her 80s, she gave her granddaughter, this is true story, a pouch, and in it is 13 feathers. And she said, when you become 80, you are to go out around the globe and find 13 grandmothers You keep one, but you have to find 12 other grandmothers. And you, 13 grandmothers, will then travel the globe and to share the wisdom that you have. And this has actually happened.
Yeah, I have a picture of them. I used to have it in this one of the lectures, yeah.
So it's interesting that since she was like 9, she had a mission to do. When
she could look forward to something really important.
And it was international and it was peaceful.
Nice. That's
so
a great point. Yes, and then we'll go to that.
I was just thinking about the journey that you're taking on this evening here from mythology and real women's lives and heroic moments, and then somewhat kind of narrowing into the cinema world here, right? And this is not all of what could possibly portray human life or what culture needs today, because we're talking about film, right? And probably male-dominated and run, right?
Yeah, still. So,
but I'm thinking about the comments in the room is about culture, and like where are we today in terms of culture and raising our children? And I have a daughter, and I'm thinking about we're in complex times. There's a complexity or an awareness of complexity that's happening. So some of the characters that people are mentioning here has to do with bringing together differences, right? So that we can solve more complex challenges. So it's like a higher level of consciousness type thinking is a heroic myth that I think is rising in the culture, but sort of being recognized in film, but I think it's that could be a subject that's being alive in the conversation right now. It's like, you know, how Bernie Sanders, his platform, for example, bring in all these differences, or the 13 grandmothers bring in these differences for a global something.
Yeah, and we're not getting all of that in the films, that's true. But there's also a way in which art, these films aren't all art, but art's always, in another way, out ahead of us. So we're also bound to see things there that we haven't got to yet. I don't think it's always the reverse. I could be wrong about that, but I always find that with art. Not, you know, all kinds of art. That because it comes from the psyche, it's really ahead of us. We're going to catch up to it. Yeah.
The heroes of ancient myths were born from the collective unconscious, right? And are you saying that maybe there's a shift going on now that the collective unconscious is creating more female heroes?
Yes, I would say that.
And so if we look back over time, what's that saying about the collective unconscious as a whole? Why was there such a lag?
That's a great question. I think because the people who got to be the spokespeople, unfortunately, most of them were men because of this.
But if the makers were the collective unconscious,
right?
They include male and female.
Yes, but it's not an equal opportunity thing. I think, you know, that as we know now, I mean, that we're no longer even thinking in terms of male-female. It's gotten much more complex than it always was, more complex than that, but that's being expressed in more nuanced ways now, even in just the last 10 years. And so, could you, as a white man, American man, have full access to a woman's experience, a transgendered person's experience, archetypally? Maybe, maybe. Maybe not. I mean, what comes through, we are shaped by our genetics, by our experience, by all kinds of things, and we become a good instrument or a good channel in certain ways. But other things are not so available to us. I mean, we all have imagination, and imagination is the psyche's way of drawing that out of us, I guess, or making us connect to what's, you know, in my dream group, for example, when we work on one dream for a while, it becomes everybody's dream. we really feel that, you know, in the room. So, yes, what you're saying is true, and yet we still have only a certain, each of us a certain range in a given lifetime, anyway. Yes, I'm sorry, Kathy.
Yes, I have two thoughts. One is, I'm really glad you brought up separation, initiation, and return, because to me it's a threat that weaves its way through any stage of life that we might be at. Internally, we separate from our current standpoint, and then we go through this literal phase, and then we reconstitute ourselves in different ways. And the other thought is, I was thinking about the shooting and the violence that goes on in films, and maybe in order for that to change, we need more than a shift in our collective understanding towards women or towards what it means to be a hero, but we need a shift in our understanding towards the ego's relationship with the self. Because what it's portraying is our relationship to things like our shadow or things like, you know, opposites and all kinds of things, and we need those areas to change in order for that to move that I'm really curious to know.
Those are great points. I think that's so true about separation, initiation, and return being. We go through it many times in a lifetime. And of course, as the unconscious tries through us to become more conscious and shadow. We keep on integrating more elements of shadow, things will continue to change. Unfortunately, we seem to keep forgetting and falling back and starting over and forgetting history, for example. You know, that seems to be a human tendency to forget what the previous generation or the last war, you know, what people learned. And as we seem to forget what we learned in the, you know, if we are reborn into a new lifetime, we seem to forget all of this hard-earned stuff that we learn in this life. So that also seems to be a factor. It isn't, in other words, my background's in archetypal psychology before Jungian psychology. It's very much against a kind of hierarchical model of development where everything keeps on continually improving. You know, when we get to higher and higher levels. I don't believe that. I think we're constantly cycling and falling back and forgetting and learning again and repeating mistakes and then finding amazing new things and wonderful breakthroughs. So it's a complex picture. Any other questions? We are at 9 o'clock. One last thing, or this was plenty. Yes.
I would just say, in reference to what you just said, I'm aware in Greek mythology that there are sort of two poles set up. There's the river of forgetfulness and the lake of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And these two operate. When a soul is about to incarnate, for example, one has to pass through the river of forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So they do, as you say, I think there are two aspects that continue with us.
Yeah. That's beautifully said. Yes, thank you. Great note to end on. Thank you.
Thank you.